All right, I think we'll get started. I assume there'll be a couple more stragglers. Just to make sure everybody knows, this is the Career and Development Series at CSIS, if this is the right place. And with us today is Ambassador Don Teitelbaum. I think you have his bio, which he was ambassador to Ghana. He was DCM in South Africa. He was at the National Security Council and a whole bunch of other places in Latin America, Lebanon, in the Middle East. And you were sort of chargé or envoy or something in Sudan. What was the...
I was chargé in Sudan for 3 years.
Yeah.
So the great relationship we have with the Sudan today, the groundwork was laid right there, right?
So with that, I'll turn it over to Don. Go ahead.
Thanks, Bill.
Turn your thing on.
Can you all hear me without the mic?
Yeah, but we're recording it.
Oh, even scarier. All the more reason not to turn on the mic. Look, let me say thanks for taking time out of your busy schedules this morning. I actually worked very hard to put together a brilliant presentation for you. Broad, but filled with, you know, little surprising witticisms, the occasional bon mot sprinkled in it like raisins in a bun, you know. It was very good. Unfortunately, about 7/8 of the way through it this morning, and I got up early for this, mind you, about 7/8 of the way through it, Windows decided that it needed to restart my computer to apply updates, and it all disappeared. So you don't get the big written version now. Now we're going to wing it.
You used to just say the dog ate it, and then you...
No, this is, well, Bill Gates ate it, I guess. But anyway, that's I think, probably better for you in some ways than not. Can I start out, since this is meant to be, although our talk today involves the Foreign Service, it involves development, can I start by asking how many of you either are already directly involved in working in the foreign affairs field or are studying or have studied it? Is this pretty much everybody? Okay. And secondly, can I ask how many of you are more focused on the development end than the diplomatic end? Okay, so divided about half and half. Good. Then I think that where I kind of wanted to go on this is to talk a little bit about sort of that development and diplomacy linkage. To the degree that we can. And this is something where I think Bill and I are probably pretty appropriate, since we actually met in 1992 and 93 in Somalia, which was a complex emergency. And I think in many ways it really shaped my thinking about the Foreign Service, about the linkages between USAID and the State Department, and about how the U.S. government deals both with humanitarian crises, with complex emergencies, and later on, development. And I think you know that Bill's perspectives on this, both as an aid professional who focused very much on emergencies and disasters for the first part of his career, and then later on doing broader development work and as chief of mission in Democratic Republic of the Congo, he also has a lot of visions of how it has been done and how it ought to be done, not necessarily the same thing. So, I wanted to be able to talk a little bit about how we've merged those things, and frankly, the merger or the blurring of the lines in development and diplomacy is continuing and accelerating, and it's also being affected by broader changes in the way we manage our relationships in the international community anyway. So I thought we'd talk about that, and then also just talk more broadly about the Foreign Service as a career. I'll try not to be a talking head for too long. I'd much rather have a real conversation and let you ask questions so we can take it from there. Let me stress, please don't be embarrassed to ask questions. If you do ask a question, I do ask you, identify yourself. Tell me who you are and what you're doing and what your background is, what your interests are, so that I can try and be more relevant to your question. Last thing I want to throw out there is that as I talk about these things, my focus tends to be State Department-centric. And Foreign Service centric. Please don't take that as meaning to dismiss or minimize the importance of the civil service or our Foreign Service national employees or locally employed staff. That is not the intention at all. But hey, we are what we are. Most of my direct experience comes from being a State Department Foreign Service officer. So that tends to be the angle I take. But again, where relevant, I try to at least at least make clear that there are other players. So I don't want it to sound as arrogant as it might without that caveat. Okay. So let me just start out by saying first and foremost, for many years, maybe there was a time when USAID and the State Department, when development and diplomacy really had sort of a firewall between them, when they were considered very, very separate things. But even when I joined, these 29 years ago, that line was blurring pretty rapidly, certainly in a complex emergency like Somalia in 92. Today, it's happening even more. And what I would say is if you look at the four pillars of our Africa policy, I don't want to get into the policy end of this a lot. If you're interested in Africa policy, the National Security Strategy for Africa is the place to start. And President Obama's companion speech in Accra in 2009 is a good piece to read in as a companion piece. The four pillars are: one, strengthening democratic institutions; two, spurring economic growth, trade, and investment; three, advancing peace and security; and four, promoting opportunity and development. And I mention these specifically because not one of them is particularly State Department specific. None of them are political officer specific. And in fact, in every one of these four, you're as likely to find a USAID democracy and governance person, for example, playing the implementing role as you are a State Department political or economic officer. Secondly, none of these things are purely policy oriented. The spurring economic growth, trade and investment, or promoting opportunities and development is as likely to be a broad development program as it is a policy initiative. And then lastly, what I would say about all of these is that they're very much interlinked. Again, there may have been a time when there were firewalls between these things. But the fact is, if you strengthen democratic institutions, if you empower people, the first thing they want is more money. People want to earn a decent living. People want good working conditions. People want opportunities. But once people have those economic opportunities, the next thing they demand is political freedoms. So I think when we look at these relationships, it shows you that none of these things in practice as policy or in terms of implementation are going to be done as purely a development strategy anymore, or an AID thing, or a State Department piece. And I say that in terms of this discussion because many of you are more development-oriented. And what I would say is if you are more development-oriented, you don't necessarily have to limit yourself to AID because they are our development, the U.S. government's development arm. Similarly, if your issue is, if you're more interested in traditional foreign policy topics, don't necessarily limit yourself to opportunities at state. There are a lot of other places to go, and AID is increasingly the visible implementing arm. Let me say, if you're looking at recent elections in Kenya, for example, state, AID, and a lot of other agencies sat down to work on our broad policies, but when it came time to actually implement, USAID's democracy and governance officers were on the scene and implementing as much as states' CSO or political officers were. Let me also say that I think one of the interesting trends that I think has been ongoing for the last couple of decades in the development world is one that is accelerating and probably needs to come over to my side at state. Starting back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, was this trend to really rationalize the way we were doing both development assistance and emergency relief and humanitarian assistance. In the early 90s, one of the big new watchwords was monetization of our food projects. Now, you can talk about whether that was the best idea or not the best idea, but it was still pretty early in the game, and at least we were stopping to say, hey, wait a minute, yes, people are hungry. Is just dropping food on them the right answer? We were starting to realize that you had a lot of unintended consequences, that people were hungry, but if dropping high-value American wheat on people, certainly it fed hungry people. But you also had a lot of local farmers who did have a crop, but their traditional crop was more likely low-value sorghum or maize. And by dropping this high-value crop for free on the market, you were having a pretty serious adverse impact on those farmers who did have a crop. Monetization was one of the answers. But what this was the beginning of a trend towards a rationalization of the way we do assistance. Monitoring and evaluation is now commonly built in a way that it once was not. And secondly, I think we're now really trying to take a much more measured and scientific approach to development. One of the things that I think we did try hard to introduce in places like Somalia and Sudan was a strong development and diplomacy relationship in which we could talk also very rationally about that political interface with development and humanitarian work, particularly in complex emergencies. When we were in places like Somalia and Sudan, state and AID officers could literally sit down and say, okay, if you're going to deliver food to this area, will we be quite literally feeding a rebellion or feeding a civil war? Are we feeding militias in conflict? Are we, when humanitarian assistance or development assistance is the only economy that exists in a place, how are you affecting it? And are you creating the peaceful situation you want? Or are you creating resources to fight over? And we were able to have some pretty good and rational discussions and to try and turn that into program design that would get us to the right places. Didn't always work the way we wanted, but I think it was a learning experience and something that we're seeing built in a lot more. I think the next step is to try and continue that and rationalize that process on the political impact side the way that humanitarian and development work has done it on the economic side, I think rather successfully. But from the State Department perspective and on the diplomacy side, I think we have a lot to learn from the development world in terms of monitoring and evaluation. Instead of simply saying, well, here's our policy, let's go implement, to say, hey, how do we measure our success or our failure? How are we going to monitor it? And I think on the diplomatic side, we haven't gone nearly as far as the development community has. But I welcome agreement or disagreement.
I agree.
Let me also say that this morphing of our relationship probably should be seen in the background, with a background of change in the way we do foreign policy and change in the way change in the role of the State Department and the way foreign policy is made in the U.S. as well. Again, I think, there was a time, probably, when state really was, I don't know if there was really a golden age of State Department or if it's just something that we fondly think was a golden age. But it was before my time in any case. But there was a time, I think, when state was, the premier foreign affairs agency. And that kind of meant that if it was foreign policy, state was going to do it. And anybody else's opinion was kind of an aside. And that world, if it ever really existed, is long gone. First of all, State Department certainly still has, legally has a primary role. But that said, the role of the Hill in formation of foreign policy and the assertiveness of the Hill in making foreign policy has changed things tremendously. The rise of the military and its role in foreign policy, particularly as implemented through the combatant commands, in our case, AFRICOM, EUCOM, PACOM, SOUTHCOM. I think the roles of non-traditional agencies, whether it be law enforcement or environment or agriculture, as the world is changing, the lines between foreign policy and domestic policy get blurred. Our trade policy at the WTO, if it affects cotton farmers or wheat farmers, is not purely a foreign policy issue. Agriculture and others become very involved. The role of the NGO and the interest group. If you look at the impact of American churches in making people aware of happenings in South Sudan or in Darfur, if you look at Invisible Children and its role in making Americans aware and causing people to care, for example, about the Lord's Resistance Army and its activities in Uganda, Central African Republic, and South Sudan. The role of interest groups and NGOs rising incredibly. And you combine that with certain accelerants, social media. 10, 20 years ago, we would have said, look, you know, as soon as something happens, it's on CNN. Today, it's someone on the scene taking photos and blogging them or forwarding them, tweeting across borders almost instantly. It really changes not just the nature of information, but the roles that individuals, you know, people will talk about the role of social media in the Arab Spring. It happens, it's changing quickly, and our international affairs agencies have to be able to try and stay ahead of this curve. Let me also say that, as I said, the other thing to look at is the blurring of what were once traditional foreign policy issues, and they're becoming domestic issues. Used to be we'd say that, you know, politics stops at the water's edge. No longer the case. But again, there are very, very few things that are truly foreign policy issues anymore. You know, almost everything in today's world has some impact on domestic policy. People know, and by the way, as soon as Americans start to care about an issue, it becomes, by definition, a domestic policy issue. If Americans care enough to write their congressman or congresswoman, it's a domestic issue. They will, you know, Americans care, constituents care, the whole cares. It has a real impact on how we do business. So I think let me lastly say that as our society evolves and our visions for what it means to be an American and what our policy goals are, that's also having a major change in our impact. Let me say that human rights in some ways has always been a part of our policy. It's part of what we are, as who we are as Americans, what we are as a people. But it was only really during the Carter administration that it was codified as part of our policy. And for what it's worth, when I joined in the mid-80s, I still heard senior Foreign Service officers, political officers, grumbling that, you know, the U.S. government has no business writing a human rights report. You know, that's what Amnesty International is for, and this is just going to get in the way of, you know, of our real work or cause problems in relationships where we need to get other real things done. Now, that attitude has changed tremendously. And I think that today, not only is it accepted, it is a real focus of our foreign policy. But even that's beginning to morph and extend. You know, what once was a focus on institutionalized racism and apartheid, for example, is now focusing on things like LGBT rights, an area in which 10 or 20 years ago you would not have seen the kind of focus today, because America is changing internally too. Let me lastly just throw out a question that often gets asked, since we've talked about these changes and the changing dynamic, the changing role of state. People will often say, you know, do we really need diplomats at this point? And I think the answer, I hope the answer is going to be yes, but it has to be more qualified. I think for the answer to be yes, diplomats have to add value. And if the answer is, if having a diplomat simply means sending someone out, which is expensive to do, and even more expensive as threats get higher, sending someone out to read the newspaper, comb through the records, make the occasional phone call to someone, and then write a report to send back home, if that's all that your diplomats are going to do, then in fact you probably can do that via Skype. You can do that. If you're just going to access databases, then you probably don't have a lot to offer. There's very little value added there. Good diplomats do add value. And the difference is, you know, to my mind, instead of saying, oh, what are the HIV infection statistics, you know, saying, oh, well, I'll look those up online, or I'll call the foreign ministry. Well, a desk officer here can look those up online and call someone at a foreign ministry. A good Foreign Service officer might still make those calls, but a good Foreign Service officer knows medical doctors who will say, you know, these are the official statistics, but let me tell you quietly that we don't like defining deaths as HIV, and therefore there are an awful lot of unknown causes if you look at our statistics, and you can count on most of those being HIV. Or, you know, we don't like to call things HIV, so you'll see a lot of tuberculosis, which isn't entirely illegitimate because there's so much co-infection, but a lot of our tuberculosis deaths are actually AIDS deaths. Being able to know someone who will feel that you're someone they can tell these things to, being able to say, hey, you know, be careful how I word this. When I say being someone who can go to, you know, the part of town and know who to talk to about sex workers. It says I want to word that carefully, not being the kind of person who knows where all the sex workers are. But being able to say, look, you know, this is an being able to say this is an underserved population. And again, when we look at the statistics here, if sex workers or other marginalized populations are not being taken into the statistics, being able to A, know it, and B, know where to go to get the straight answer, that is value added. That's where having someone on the scene changes our perception of a country and changes our perception of A, whether or not there's a problem, and B, how to deal with it. And creating that kind of value added is what we really need to do. So with that, I think I'll probably stand down on the policy side and then segue over to career stuff.
Yep.
Should we open to questions now, or
no,
should
why don't
we
you
do the career stuff?
And then we'll catch it all later.
All right. Well, let me just say, first and foremost, the State Department is hiring. Not as many as we'd like to be. Budgets are tight for everybody. But we have hired. We, until very recently, have still been in growth mode. And let me just say, first off, since I said I was talking mostly about the Foreign Service and the State Department, let me start out by saying what the State Department is. The State Department and the Foreign Service are not in any way, shape, or form synonymous. The State Department is simply one subset. The Foreign Service is one subset. There are about 14,000 Foreign Service officers and specialists. I think we're probably about, I have a number here, about 8,000 generalist Foreign Service officers and about 6,000 specialists. The 8,000 officers are your political officers, economic officers, management officers, consular officers, public diplomacy officers. The specialists involve a dozen and a half, two dozen specialties, everything from medicine to accounting to security to engineering. The specialists are the people who make the Foreign Service operate to a large degree. The Foreign Service generalists are sort of what you would commonly think of as diplomats and diplomatic staff who do the more traditional work of diplomacy. But without specialists, the lights don't turn on, nobody gets paid, the cars don't run, everybody gets sick and dies. It's a bad scene for everybody. And about two-thirds of that of the Foreign Service are overseas at our 275-odd missions at any given time, and about one-third are back home, mostly in Washington, although we have some posts in other places. We're increasingly on loan to other agencies, particularly DOD. And we increasingly are taking people from other agencies into the State Department to play a liaison role. There's also a very substantial civil service presence in the in the State Department. Civil service is, I think, about 11,000. Most of whom are working in the Washington area, although we have passport offices and the like scattered around the country, and some civil servants will be overseas at embassies as well at any given time. We also have probably 45,000 locally employed staff, mostly Foreign Service nationals, but also third country nationals who move around the world and work with us. There are big differences, and what I would say is, there has in the past certainly been a problem of classism within the State Department. I think that's changing and for the better. There's a recognition that I think a lot of everybody adds value. What's right for you really depends on what you're looking for. And I'm obviously interested in enticing people into the Foreign Service. But let me say, you got to ask yourself why you want to join, if any of you are interested at all. I hope you will be. But when people tell me, hey, I'm thinking about joining the Foreign Service, my first question is always, well, why? Why do you want to be in the Foreign Service? What do you want to do? And if they tell me, well, I'm really interested in China policy, and I speak great Chinese, and I want to develop my Chinese, I want to get better and better at this. This is my focus. I often tell them the Foreign Service may not be the place for you. If you really want to focus on China and China policy, you join the Foreign Service, you'll get to China. Your Chinese will probably get pretty good, but it is the State Department and the U.S. government. Your first tour may be in Monterrey, Mexico, stamping visas and have nothing to do with China. You will get to China, but you can't count on always being there. And frankly, you may not be making China policy. You'll be implementing China policy. But if making that China policy is important to you, you might be happier on the Hill, where you can really focus on China policy. You might be happier at a think tank, where your expertise on China will be what you do 24/7, well, or at least 8 to 10, 5. You might be happier, if you tell me your interest is in politico-military affairs. We do have a politico-military affairs bureau. You might not always be doing that. If that's really your interest, you might be happier in the civil service. In many cases, the civil service is the State Department's repository of real knowledge, of in-depth knowledge. If you want to do 20 years understanding politico-military affairs in Central Europe, there will be somebody whose job that is, and probably several people whose job that is in the State Department. They will be civil servants. That's the repository of that kind of focus. So if that's your interest, the civil service might be the better place for you. To my mind, the one of the best answers to join the Foreign Service to say that I want to see the world. You know, if moving around and spending two-thirds of your career overseas and moving every 3 years or so and seeing the world, and the world doesn't just mean London and Paris and Brussels, although they're part of the world. It also means, Accra, Ghana, and Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Mexico City. So if those things sound like fun, if that sounds like an exciting way to spend the next 20 or 30 years, trust me, there's almost nothing else you can do. If that doesn't sound like a great idea, almost nothing else about it will make up for the problems that it brings you. So think about the lifestyle issue as much as the career interest issue, because most of the career interest issues you can do at other agencies, AID, and within the State Department without the Foreign Service part of it. So I think that's sort of a big part of it. Otherwise, let me just say we're offering the exam 3 times a year for Foreign Service officers. If you're interested in being a specialist, if you have the skill qualifications, we do not have the written exam process for specialists. But if any of you are medical doctors or engineers already, or CPAs, we can talk about that. But there's a separate entrance process for our specialist corps. But for generalists, the exam's being offered 3 times a year. And if let me just say for specifics, careers.state.gov, first place to go. Civil service jobs get listed on usajobs.gov, but go through careers.state.gov first, because it'll give you a lot more information on the specifics. I think the jobs USA website is really more of a listing and not very descriptive. So with that, I'll get off my soapbox, I think.
Okay, well, let me ask you one question, kind of going back to the first part, if you all think about what you want to ask them after that. Going back to one of your earlier jobs, you were at the National Security Council.
I was.
How does that relate to the State Department and foreign policy? Why? What makes the NSC kind of a unique place or different?
Well, the NSC is a fascinating place to work, let me just say. First of all, for those of you who have studied foreign affairs at all, you know that there's sort of ever since its founding, there's been a tension between the State Department and the National Security Council. I think there's no real, there's nothing really new there. So as a State Department officer going over there to work for a couple of years, it was very interesting. I mean, frankly, it gives you, I actually highly commend it to my Foreign Service friends. I urge them to either do a year or two at the White House and or to do a year or two on the Hill. Because if you're in the State Department, you tend to take a very State Department-centric view of things. And you go to the White House, and it's very interesting. Again, we tend to be the hey, it's a foreign policy issue, where are our foreign policy interests side? If you go to the Hill, they tend to look at every issue and say, well, is there a domestic, what is the relationship to our domestic politics? If there is none or if it's very marginal, a lot of people on the Hill will say, well, I'll leave that to the committee or to someone else. If you have a constituency that cares, it becomes a domestic issue for you. And being able to get that, to look at, we can all look at the same thing, but we see it from a different angle. And coming at it from the White House angle, very, very interesting for me. I mean, we have laws that are supposed to separate partisan politics from White House activity. And seeing those laws in practice was really interesting for me. Seeing their attempt to firewall it off, and you could do that in terms of saying, hey, you can't ask your National Security Council staff to write campaign speeches. And, you know, saying, okay, but they can write about foreign policy issues that might get used in a speech. You know, it's very difficult to write these things. But more importantly, you do get a window into the idea that if you're a president and you need to be reelected in a couple of years, talking about your foreign policy successes is, in fact, a big portion of your foreign policy. So getting that new angle on things was really interesting for me. And I think at the policy formation level, you need to be able to work that in. Talking about this changing world, if you take this old, only state-centric view, you're going to send forward policy recommendations that get shot down by the White House or that are never going to pass muster on the Hill because you didn't think about these other equities. And you really do need to think about all the other equities. And this is where the other thing that would come in is talking about human rights and these other issues. Our national interests often compete. You know, a company wants to invest in a country with human rights issues. We want to push them on the issue, but we don't want to harm some American company's opportunity to make some money, create jobs, create a better working environment in the country in which they're investing. How do you know, where do you go from this? You have to balance these things, but also being able to truly understand where the White House is going to come down, where the Hill is likely to come down, as well as American businesses, NGOs that care about human rights or the environment, and in fact, in most cases, almost everybody cares to some degree about all these things. The question is where they put their emphasis. But having worked at the NSC, I think it gave me a much better insight into being able to understand the position that others were going to take, and I think it made me more effective.
Good. Questions? Comments? I can't believe you don't have any questions.
Great. Hi, I'm Alex Young. I'm a junior undergrad at American University, studying international relations and development. I'm curious where you really struck your interest and how you kind of developed your education or your early career in getting where you are today, and where you really found, at what point did you realize this is where I want to end up, or if you have ever realized that?
I wish I had a better answer for you. You know, I kind of fell into it. Look, I do come from a multicultural family. I come from a multicultural family. My mother was not born in the United States. My family moved a lot when we were little. So I've always had an interest and I think a certain receptivity to other cultures and a willingness to move. I've not had terribly deep roots in any one place. And I think that made a difference. But as far as having a big plan, I was an international relations major, foreign affairs major. But I'm pretty sure that when I had to declare my major, I have a sneaking suspicion that there weren't a lot of 8 o'clock classes in international relations or something. And that had a big impact on the major I declared. I certainly had an interest in foreign policy. And I took the exam as an undergraduate and surprised the hell out of myself by passing. I sort of fell into it. But let me just say, you know, despite having fallen into it, I don't know if this is common, but I rather suspect it's not. Let me just say that almost 29 years into it, I've had some great days in the Foreign Service, and I've had some really, really bad days, too. And if you do 29 years in the service, that's kind of going to be par for the course. I think the highs are really high, and I will tell you now that the lows are really, really low. But I don't think I've ever once said, I wish I had done something else. You know, if only I'd gotten that law degree or gone into banking or whatever. And I don't know how many people can say that 29 years into it. I mean, I love what I do. It is a chance to do something that's important, to affect people's lives very positively if you get things right, and to remember that you can and will affect people's lives very negatively if you get it wrong. It's a great thing every day. and there's no question about the importance of the work and the impact that you have. So I kind of fell into it, but I've always felt very lucky to have done so, and have never not only not regretted it, I've never seen anything else I'd rather do.
Hi, I'm Emily. I work here at CSAS. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about your role specifically during the complex relief crisis in Somalia or other efforts that you were a part of in your time abroad.
Well, in Somalia, for example, I started covering Somalia in the summer of 1992. We had evacuated our embassy in 1991. So we did not have an embassy in country, and starting in the summer of 92, as the Somalia watcher at the embassy based out of Nairobi, I started flying into Somalia and spend anything from a few days to a few weeks at a time. I stayed at various places, whatever was available. Sometimes I stayed at houses that had been owned by American companies or that were willing to host me. Sometimes I stayed with NGOs. And I was pretty much the interface for most things U.S. government at that point, since we didn't have a presence. But we were delivering huge amounts of relief aid. And we had a USAID DART team that was going in and out as well. And frankly, you know, it was kind of the Wild West. We had a lot of money and millions of people at risk of starvation, a lot of very, very courageous NGO workers, as well as Red Cross and UN agencies doing remarkable work at considerable risk. So really, it was a chance to go in and define my own role. I did go in and I did some political reporting. I met with the warlords. But it was also a chance to go in terms of relief. I looked at it pretty early on, and in discussions with some truly outstanding NGO workers and AID professionals, you know, we could sit down and say, you know, in a lot of places, this relief food is moving in. We want to feed people who are starving, but the relief food moving in, the guards that are being hired to guard NGO compounds, and to guard relief food and programming is also in many cases providing money to these warring parties. We also wanted to say, and is the relief food going into these areas? Are we creating something to fight over? And then also saying, and we know NGOs want to be neutral. I've very rarely met an NGO that didn't at least profess neutrality. There are a few that don't. They'll say we're not neutral. We're an advocacy organization, or we've taken a side. It's not unheard of, but 98% of them will say no. We're neutral. Especially in a complex emergency, they'll say, look, there's a conflict here. We're just here to provide humanitarian relief to those who need it. We're neutral. But I think a lot of us looked at this and said, you know, we believe that you are saying it, and we believe you mean it, and you're saying it in good faith. But that said, professing neutrality. And many of you would say, well, what about this issue that you know, the money you bring, the people you hire, your clans? They say, I don't want to know about that. I'm neutral. And I think one of the things that we came out of this saying was you have to be activist to be neutral. Neutrality and ignorance, you know, cannot be the same thing. Saying, I'm neutral, so I don't want to care about the politics of this situation. I don't want to care about the political and ethnic or religious dynamic. That's an unsatisfactory answer in most cases. And one of the things that I think we came to realize was that, and this is something that we worked on then and need to continue to work on now, is that you do have an impact. The presence of humanitarian relief workers in a complex emergency is very often, I don't want to call it a driver of conflict, but it's a factor in conflict. And if you want to be neutral, you have to start with a very substantial understanding of the situation around you, of the dynamic that surrounds you, and then consciously work that into your program and say, how am I going to prevent myself from becoming a player? Because simply professing neutrality is not enough. And, you know, and when people ask you something, say, hey, I'm neutral. Well, you know what? Nobody around you is neutral. You know, they're all in a serious conflict. People are dying in large numbers. Warlords are fighting a war around you, and your desire to be neutral is unlikely to be respected by choice. And people will do two things. One, they will use you and your resources to their advantage. Or if they choose not to, they will very likely interpret your activities as being perhaps intentional when they are not. So one of the things that I think we really did work on as a group, both relief workers and those of us on the policy side, was to say, how do we work to rationalize this? What can we do to help NGOs practice a sort of activist neutrality? And that's something that I've been interested in ever since, and I think we need to continue to work on.
Hi, I'm Vruti Patel from the Kyle House Group, the consulting firm here in D.C. I'm just curious, I'm trying to pick between three questions I have, but I'm curious as to what your largest criticism of the State Department is in your experience. I noticed you said that you had really, you know, highs and some really low lows, and whether they're connected to the bureaucracy that is typically labeled whenever people think about the State Department, or if it was sort of external factors. Just kind of getting a realistic perspective on the other side that people may not know of.
Well, I think I can tell you my biggest criticism. It isn't necessary. My biggest criticisms are not related to my biggest lows. I think my worst days in the Foreign Service have relatively little to do with the Foreign Service or the U.S. government or how we manage the State Department and the Foreign Service. My lowest days, among them, I would probably include, say, the Nairobi bombing. You know, you have a few dozen friends killed in one morning, that's a low. But I think that I fundamentally hold responsible those who committed the act. That's Osama bin Laden and the people who actually committed the act, who, you know, killed men, and not just my American colleagues and my FSN colleagues at the embassy, but many, many innocent Kenyans just who happened to be in the area when the bomb went off. But I would say that kind of event, and I've been through a goodly number of them, is definitely the low end. And I don't think that's really about it. It's part of the experience, but it's not something that I think you can generally prevent. I mean, you can pick apart the actions after the fact, and you know, we do. I mean, you have to learn from these tragedies. But that said, I think most Foreign Service officers and Foreign Service specialists, and indeed most of our local employees at an embassy, will say, we understand that we accept a certain degree of risk by choosing this as a career. It's a little tougher on your local employees, many of whom, you know, are at home, and for them it's a different equation. For American staff, it's a much more conscious decision. But in terms of criticisms of the State Department, I think I would probably say, and this is just my own opinion, I can't say I'm speaking for the State Department in general, but I think that it probably applies to much of government. I think that there is an irrational fear of failure, and that it handicaps us. Now, I'm not going to say that failure is in and of itself a good thing, but I do think that failure is an important part of improvement. That if you want to hit a home run, you got to be willing to strike out. And if you want to have big successes, you have to take risks. And we often hear in government people say, you should behave like a business, you know, try and run like a business. You should be like a CEO and do things like a business does. Fair enough. I think there's a lot that we in government can and should learn from business. But one of the things that I think that successful businesses do and great businesses do is they allow themselves to fail. And in the U.S. government, and I'm going to say in particular in our foreign affairs agencies, certainly at the State Department, and I think very much so at AID, this fear of failure limits us, that because we don't want to fail, we tend to take the safe path forward. We have a lot of experts at USAID who I believe can and know how to be on the cutting edge of programming. That when you look at what we know from our research at CDC, our HIV and AIDS programming in many ways ought to be really cutting edge stuff, bleeding edge stuff, and it's not. And I'm convinced it's because when you do a cutting-edge program, there's a chance that it's not going to work the way you planned. And then when it fails, people start picking it apart and asking how you wasted the taxpayers' money, you know, and it becomes very often a free-for-all. And that's too bad, because good businesses take risks and fail. They strike out occasionally to hit that home run. Now, I think our tendency is often to go to the default position. You go to the, you go with the program that you've implemented many times before, and you, as an implementer, you go to the NGO that's implemented this program many times before. It's not a bad program, and it will be a success. It certainly won't be a failure. But is it going to be a home run? Probably not. It wasn't the time before, and it won't be the next time. And I think that fear, that fear of failure means an inability to take risks. So what I'll say is, anybody here ski? I mean, you know, if falling down is a problem for you, you're never going to be very good. And that's my biggest problem. I often say to people, anybody here old enough to remember the Apple Lisa? Have any of you ever heard of the Apple Lisa? That should tell you something. Go, when you're done, go to your smartphones and Google Apple Lisa, L-I-S-A. Okay, it was a horrible bomb of a product from Apple. But the point is, you know, and they didn't suddenly stop and say, oh my God, we're a failure as a company. How could this happen? Let's start firing the R&D people. They said, look, you know, let's learn from this and move forward. And I think that's what we need to do. The State Department and AID and much of the U.S. government needs to be a lot more comfortable with risk-taking. And risk-taking means being a lot more comfortable with failure than we have been. By the way, let me stress, just my opinion and no way, shape, or form that of the U.S. government.
My name's Allison, and I'm an undergrad at American University studying international development and global health. So you mentioned that you think that good diplomats make the relationships abroad and go talk to the people on the ground. Could you talk about some of the strategies that you've used in your experience to build those relationships and what you've found works really well and what doesn't work so well?
It's a good question, but it's not one that I'm sure and I can tell you what I've done, but that doesn't mean it's going to work for anybody else. I think every individual has to find his or her own style. Every individual has to find what works for him or her. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't some general rules, and I'll say, you know, I think that the two prime attributes of the successful diplomat are curiosity. I mean, if you don't care about people and places and issues, then why are you doing this? And you can't be successful. You know, being willing to work hard isn't enough. You have to have some curiosity. And then secondly, I think in tandem with that, I would say integrity. If you can't be trusted by your colleagues and by your interlocutors, then really what good are you? But I think those are the two primary attributes. And beyond those things, I think mostly what we're talking about is style. If you are, you know, let me just say, if you're naturally an outgoing, gregarious person who wants to go make all sorts of relationships, then certain kinds of things will be easier for you. If you are not, then I'm not going to say, well, you have to go become one of those. You can see I've overcome my painful shyness. But if you are a shyer individual, I'm not going to say, well, you have to go be like this other person or take someone else's style to be successful. Some people will do better being that person who has a shotgun approach and, you know, they've never met a person they didn't like. They take everyone's phone number and they have absolutely no shame in calling that person 6 months later saying, remember when we were at the grocery store and I was standing behind you, you know, you were buying produce and I was buying canned goods, but you told me that you work at the electric company. Well, I have some questions about electric. Can we have lunch? Can you come over? You know, I mean, if that's your personality, great. I mean, that's going to work for you. If that's not you, trying to force the issue is never going to work. If you're the kind of person who has fewer relationships but deeper ones, then that's what you need to play to. And if you have a deep interest, you know, again, these things don't have to be greatly contrived. It's about knowing your culture and knowing people. If you're an avid tennis player, then go out and play tennis and meet people who play tennis. You're going to meet a lot of local people who will have a relationship with you. You don't have to play someone else's game. But I do think that, one, you have to have that innate curiosity. If you don't have that, then really nothing else is gonna correct it.
I noticed that when you were talking about your experience with the National Security Council, how it deepened your experience in being able to take in a lot of factors in at once. And I was just hoping you could give an example of a situation where, you know, you're required to maybe come up with some policy recommendations, how you sort of went through the process, what you learned from the process, et cetera.
Let me clarify this a bit. So, in the broad policy process, or...
To be quite honest with you, I'm not really sure exactly what you would have had to decide on at the National Security Council, but I think it's sort of rare to hear about that experience. And so if there's a sort of process that you had to go through in terms of writing up a policy memo, like I don't even know if that's actually the logistical term for it, and just kind of talking about how you sort of went through it and what you learned from it.
Okay. Well, certainly what I would say is my impression is that the NSC's role is less defined, and in many ways, therefore, more free, less constrained than a lot of other agencies. Remember, it's not an agency. It's really just White House staff. It's not constitutionally defined. The National Security Advisor does not have to be confirmed by the Senate. So the National Security Council is two or three things. The council itself is determined by law. And that makeup you can read. That's in all the books. But in many ways, I think in practical terms, the National Security Council, and this is where I think a lot of the competition comes in with the State Department. The State Department has a defined role to be the foreign affairs agency. But in practical terms, the National Security Advisor is also, and the National Security Advisor's staff also play a de facto advisory role to the president. And with that in mind, I think that the influence of the National Security Council on policy making and at the White House is critical. Even when there's no desire, there's no desire to push policy or to lead it, the NSC has several roles. One is to coordinate the interagency process. But even this coordination can be either active or passive. If there's in many cases where, say, the Department of State and Department of Defense and Department of Treasury might have a disagreement on applying economic sanctions, whether it's Iraq or to Yemenis or something like this. That would involve a number of agencies. And for example, commerce could get involved. You'd say, well, wait a minute, American companies might be sanctioned, or you're gonna limit American opportunities. You might find very often that you get very, very different viewpoints from the agencies. The Department of Commerce might come in and say, look, we really don't like this idea of sanctions. There are several major American companies that stand to lose a lot of money, which could cost a lot of jobs in America. And then you might find the State Department saying, we take the complete opposite view. We believe it's important to make a stand on the issue. DOD might come in somewhere in the middle saying, okay, you can have sanctions, but our bilateral military programming should be kept separate. At the very least, the NSC will be the mechanism in which these things are discussed as an interagency process. They make it formal, and they would, at the very least, host these discussions. But in practice, the NSC, even when you're sort of the, let me put it this way, even a referee can have a huge impact on how the game comes out. It might just be that as a more or less neutral player, there's still influence there. There are also times when the NSC will come in and say, no, let's be clear about where the White House is coming from. And again, it doesn't mean you would say, this is the White House position, we go forth and implement. Usually they'll say, well, wait a minute, we want to understand where everyone is coming from, and we do want to guide this, but we also have to make clear, there's a White House priority or a White House policy that we need to make sure is reflected here. I'll give you a great example. If you look at... when you talk about broader policies, we're talking about human rights, LGBT rights, you can look at this, and in almost any issue, you'll have several competing interests. But this is where the White House will come in and say, hey, the president said this is our position on human rights and on LGBT rights in particular, yes, you know, we want to hear this discussion, but at the end of the day, our policy does need to reflect what the president said it would be. And that's why you have things like this national security strategy and the four pillars. It's a good question to say, hey, we, you know, it's not that we don't want agencies to have freedom of movement, but the president was, you know, the Foreign Service and the Foreign Service of the State Department, the State Department, DOD, you guys weren't elected. The president was. This is the policy that the people have voted on and that the president has promised, and we do want to make sure that the agencies are broadly in line with that policy. Or at least if we're not going to be, then it was a conscious decision about which the president and the White House can be aware and in agreement.
Thank you.